and welcome. You are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical, grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible, and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Hello. We're continuing our study in Acts. We've been in Ephesus. We've seen the tremendous revival that broke out, the power of God overcoming so many barriers, the barrier of Jewish opposition, barriers of superstitious pagan worship, barriers of magic incantations. Wow, what a revival was happening. Now, beginning in verse 21, we're going to follow Paul as he begins to move to some of the other cities, although we're going to continue something that happened in Ephesus. Verse 21. Now, these events have been brought to a close. Paul, under the guidance of the Spirit, decided... Now, there's really a problem in the Greek text here, not as far as the appropriate words, but how to understand the words. For the words, Paul decided in spirit. There's been a question, should be a capital H spirit, meaning the Holy Spirit led Paul, as he did back in chapter 16, verse 6? Or is this the idea that Paul decided in himself to do this? Well, I really think, again, Paul was a man who wanted God's will, and I think it's referring to the Holy Spirit here. And here's a good battle between the Holy Spirit led him, but Paul decided to implement it. Well, that's the way most of the Christian faith is. God leads us, or God woos us, or God draws us, but we must decide to implement it. And I think that truths what we have here. To pass through Macedonia. Now, he's going to go back up around the Aegean Sea to Macedonia. He's in Corinth, in Ephesus now, in the province of Asia, the western end of Turkey. He's going to go back up around now to modern Greece. And Greece on his way to Jerusalem. Now, he wanted to go back to Jerusalem. This is probably the time he was taking the contribution from all of the churches. It was very important for Paul to link the Jewish church and the Gentile church, and this contribution that he saw done at Antioch, he implemented in his own ministry. That contribution is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and following, 2 Corinthians 8, 1 and following, and Romans 15, 25 and following. Saying, after I have gone there, I must see Rome too. Now, the word must is the word dia, moral necessity. It's important to remember that Paul wanted to go to Spain. He wanted to not build another man's foundation. Someone else had started the church at Rome, probably not Paul or Peter, but maybe some disciples from Pentecost. We're just not sure how the church started, but it was a strong church. But Paul wanted to visit there to impart some gift to them. He mentions that in Romans 15, 24 and 28. And yet, at Paul's conversion, it is mentioned in the conversation between God and Ananias that Paul would speak to the Gentile kings. We find that in Acts 9, 15. Now, Paul's going to be real surprised how he's going to get there. And Paul wasn't expecting to speak to Caesar, but speak to the church. But God's got a different plan, and Paul recognized God's sovereignty and yields himself to that plan. Now, in verse 22, so he set off for Macedonia, sent off two of his assistants, Timothy and Erastus. Now, they're going to prepare the way in Macedonia, tell him Paul's coming, get things ready, and so they're already on the way. Now, Erastus is mentioned several times. In Romans 16:23, there's his same name, is the treasurer of the city of Corinth. Some think it's the same man. I'm not sure that high of official could be off on a mission trip. Another Erastus is mentioned in 2 Timothy 4:20. Whether it's the same one or not, we just can't be sure. Now, verse 23. Now, just about the time, a great commotion arose about the way. Now, of course, the way is the earliest title for believers. They were first called Christians at Antioch, but before that, they're called the Way. We see it in Acts 9, verse 2, Acts 19, 9 and 23, Acts 22, 4, and Acts 24, verses 19 and 22. Excuse me, I think it's 14 and 22. My writing gets so small sometimes. The Way primarily emphasizes that Christianity is not a creed or an emotional response, it is a lifestyle. It is a lifestyle, not only a commitment to a person, but commitment to following that person's will throughout life. And it's not a fuzzy will or an ambiguous will, but it's like a well-worn footpath. God has given us the guidelines on how to follow Him. And so it's important that we implement those. And that's the idea behind the way. Now, this great commotion, I think the Greek has no little stir here, as kind of a Luke's characteristic way of saying that. It was a big stir, and it caused real problems. Now, silversmith named Demetrius by manufacturing silver shrines of Artemis. Now, Demetrius seems to be the head of a guild of craftsmen. And they made not images of Artemis, and I'm going to talk about Artemis in just a second, but they made replicas of her temple. Now, her temple was one of the seven wonders of the world, made out of white marble with inlaid gold. It was four times bigger than the Pantheon in Athens. A huge city. I mean, a huge temple. But this Artemis, some translations call her Diana, which is the Roman goddess, but this is not really Artemis and Diana of the Greek and Roman pantheon, who was a chaste, huntress person. This is more like the mother goddess worship, known as Cybele, of the Eastern mystery religions. And the reason is this. This is a full-blown fertility cult. We're talking about men and women prostitutes, eunuch priests. This temple had become a sanctuary for criminals. It was something else. They had prostitutes that went down into the city. And it was a wild kind of thing. So I think it's closer to Cybele, a mother goddess. Now notice that we found archaeologically 27 sites around the Mediterranean world where this goddess was worshipped. And so when Demetrius is going to mention that this goddess worshipped all the world, it was true. Now, was bringing great profits to his workmen. Now the word here is technicians. This is the idea that these craftsmen were making a lot of money with these old shrines. Now archaeologists have found some of the clay shrines, but not the silver. And that's not unusual. They've probably been melted down after this goddess fell in disrepute. And he called his workmen together and others engaged in similar trades and said to them, this is Demetrius, his wild flame fanning to get Paul put out of the city. Men, you know well how our prosperity depends on this business of ours. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but all over the province of Asia, Roman province of Asia, this man Paul has led away a vast number of people by persuading them and telling them that gods made by human hands are not gods at all. Isn't this exciting? Here is a pagan affirming the success of the gospel through Paul. Apparently not only in Ephesus, but in the province, that whole province of Asia. Now, probably this is where Hierapolis, Laodicea, and Colossae were started in this time. Think of the influence Paul must have had for this man to do this. Now, he says that he's talking about idolatry. Now, this idolatry, by the way, I want to mention, you know, this physical prosperity, I did about a vast numbers being led away. You might want to see in chapter 19, verse 10, 17, and 20 for this other success that Paul was having. This idea about a profit motive, we can see that back with the slave girl in Philippians 16. It was a big motive. How much this is religious and how much this is monetary, one wonders. I think it's primarily monetary. Now, that's where it says he's talking primarily about idolatry or these little idols that these men were making. This seems to follow Isaiah 44, 9 through 17, that mocks idolatry and things made with human hands. And this seems to me to go back to the sermon that Paul preached on Mars Hill, or the Hill of Ares, whichever one of the names, Greek or Roman, you take. In chapter 17, 24 and 25, and verse 29 particularly. So Paul's message about idolatry and the frivolity of that focuses in right here. Now, the danger facing us is not only that our business will lose its reputation, but also the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be brought to contempt, and she whom all Asia and all the world now worships. Well, that was kind of braggadocious, but again, we found 27 places archaeologically where this fertility goddess was worshipped in the Mediterranean area. So I think there's some credibility about the widespreadness of this particular goddess. Verse 28. And when they heard this, they became furious and kept on shouting, "Great Artemis of Ephesus!" And that must have been a shout they do during their spring festival. And in the spring festival, close to the time we're talking about right now, is when people came from all over the Mediterranean world to worship this goddess in many kind of sexual acts and rituals and processions. And so this must have been the chant they used in this worship time. So the whole city was thrown into confusion, and with one impulse, the people rushed into the theater. Now, we have found this theater archaeologically on the main road through Ephesus. And it holds between 25 and 26,000 people. Now, these theaters were usually used for city meetings and divine plays like emperor worship. So here, it was the place they normally met for the city council meetings or whatever. They rush in this theater, and they drag two Macedonians, Gaius and Archicus, with them. Now, Gaius, there's several Gaiuses mentioned in the New Testament. There's one in Acts 20, verse 4. It says he's from Derbe. Now, this says he's from Macedonia. Maybe it's a different Gaius. There's another mentioned in 1 Corinthians 1:14. There's another mention in Romans 16:23, and another in 3 John 1. Well, there's four different ones, 3, 2, 1, I'm not sure. It seems to be there are several different men by this name, very common name. Now, this Aristarchus is mentioned in Acts 20, verse 4, Acts 27, 2, and Colossians 4, 10 and 11, and in Philemon 24. So he is a common helper and companion with Paul. Paul's traveling companion. They apparently couldn't find Paul. They happened to find these two men and took them with them. Paul wanted to go into the assembly and address the people, but the disciples would not let him. Paul was a very brash, bold man. Now, in private, sometimes he was very timid and shy, and the Holy Spirit had to continue to encourage him by visions. But he was not a coward, boy. He was ready to go into this mob and defend the gospel to them. But the disciples wouldn't let him. Several times through Acts, the believers associated with Paul will not let him do what he wants to or will take him off out of danger. You might want to see Acts 9:25, Acts 9:25, Acts 9:30, Acts 17, 10, and 14 for some other examples of believers stopping him or leading him somewhere. Verse 31. Some of the public officials in Asia who were friendly to him also sent word to him begging him not to risk himself in the theater. That amazes me in two ways. These officials are called Asiarchs. Now, the historicity of Luke is amazing. In every province, he knows the exact title of the different leaders. And friends, these titles change from province to province and from periods of the Roman Empire to periods of the Roman Empire. Luke's history is excellent. Now, these Asiarchs were leading wealthy men of the community. They were voted on, but they had to publicly sponsor the athletic games and the worship of Rome, the Caesar worship, or the Roman worship of the god Roma. And so they had to fund these and organize these. So there were very influential and wealthy men, several of them in a province. One of them was a personal friend of Paul. Isn't that amazing? The gospel had penetrated the wealthy elite class that put on the festivals for the Roman worship. Isn't that amazing? Shows the influence of this man Paul and the wide group from slaves to very rich and wealthy influential people that he influenced. Now, they said, please keep Paul out of here. Verse 32. So they kept on shouting, some one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion. Obviously, it's a mob. Now, the word assembly is interesting. We see it down here in verse 39 also. It is the term ecclesia, the same term as was used for the church. It was a Greek word for a town assembly. It was a Roman free city, a Roman colony. And here they were rioting. They could have lost their Roman colony status because they had no excuse for that. So it was a very dangerous thing happening in this city, this confusion like this. Now, let's see. And the majority of them did not know why they had met. Isn't that just like a mob that heard a bunch of screaming, they went to it and just joined in, not knowing what the whole deal was? Verse 33. Some of the crowd concluded that it was Alexander, since the Jews had pushed him up to the front, and since Alexander had made a gesture of his hand as though he would make a defense before the people. Now, the word defense here is the English word apology. Now, Alexander is Jewish. There's been much discussion among commentators exactly what's happening. It seems that once the Jews saw this terrible riot potential that was occurring over the issue of idolatry, and the people knew the Jews were against idolatry as well as the Christians, the Jews seemed, this is all conjecture, seemed to push one of their men up front and say, you tell them that it's these Christians, not us Jews, that are causing this trouble about idolatry. Now, isn't that funny? They had to make a defense that they weren't against idolatry to protect themselves. But friends, this man must have looked Jewish, because or someone recognized him as a Jew and said, "Jew, Jew." And when he raised his hand, apparently to try to get attention, they started shouting even louder for 2 hours. "Great is Artemis of Ephesus." Boy, what a mob scene. Alexander didn't get a word in. Now, verse 35. "At last the city recorder." Now, this guy is a very high official, maybe the highest official, like a mayor. Now, he was the one who kept the official records and was the liaison with the Roman officials of the province. So he was the one that probably usually conducted the town meeting. He waited. This was a smart guy. He waited till they almost screamed themselves hoarse. And he found out the facts about this. He knew that Demetrius had caused this. He knew it was over some Christian proclamation. He got all the facts behind the scene. Let this mob kind of burn their frenzy out. And then he stood up. And when he stood up, he demanded some respect. "Men of Ephesus, who in the world does not know the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple of the great Artemis?" Now, the word guardian here originally meant temple sweeper. But it came to be an idea of a temple guardian or keeper. So he is starting out in a very tactful way. He must have been a very learned and wise man. He's kind of saying, "We know what you're doing. It has truth to it." That's what he's saying. "And that an image fell down from heaven." Now, this is the theory. The word heaven here may be the idea of the word from Zeus. We're just not sure. They claim that this image of this fertility goddess was like a meteorite that fell from the gods. Now, it was not the image of a beautiful woman like you might think. It was a kind of a roughed-out image of a woman-type form with many breasts, symbol of fertility nature. It was a very ugly-looking image, but they think it fell from heaven. That's the tradition here. "So as this cannot be denied, you must be quiet and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here, although they are not guilty of sacrilege." And this is the word temple robbing. They hadn't stolen anything from the temple, nor abusive speech against our goddess. They hadn't blasphemed the goddess. "So then, if Demetrius and his fellow workmen," notice that he knew what had happened, who started it and why, "have a charge against anybody, there are courts and judges. Let them go to the law." It's a present imperative. Let them do the proper way. Let them go through the channels. They have something in problem. And so he says, we're in danger of being caused with a riot, and we have no answer for it, not a single reason. And so he dismissed them, and they went home. Wow, what a deal. Well, this was soon to be close to this spring time, because Paul wants to make Pentecost, this would be about April, May, and this festival is about then, so he's going to leave the city. "When the uproar had ceased," now how long after the uproar, we don't know, "Paul sent for the disciples and encouraged them, and then bade them goodbye and started off for Macedonia." That's what he wanted to do back in chapter 19:21 when this riot broke out, and he stayed through it. "He passed through the districts by continuing to talk to them, encouraging the people." Now this is the idea. He passed through the provinces, going back around the Aegean over to Macedonia. You might want to see Romans 15:19, where this may be discussed. "So he went on to Greece." And we think this idea of Corinth here, that's where he's going to stay, where he stayed for 3 months. This seems to be the winter season. The sea travel was dangerous in the winter months, and Paul always avoided it. You might want to see Acts 27:12, Acts 28:11, and Titus 3:12, where Paul avoids winter sea travel. He wanted to stay with Corinth. The church had a real problem. Many folks try to say, well, he wrote up Romans from here and Corinth, 1 Corinthians from here and 2. I am not real up on all the theories about where and when Paul wrote all his letters. I also think it's a bit ambiguous to try to fit all the epistles that Paul wrote into Acts with confidence. And so I'm a little nervous about forming those kind of opinions. If you buy 2 or 3 commentaries, you'll get 2 or 3 opinions. I think it's best just not to speculate. The epistles add a lot of information to Acts, but the exact chronology and the exact dating is certainly uncertain. "Stayed there about 3 months, just as he was about to sail for Syria." Now, apparently, Paul wanted to make Passover in Jerusalem. And there was pilgrim ships, because the Jews, all the Jewish males, were commanded to attend if they could. So pilgrim ships kind of hugged the coastline of all these Gentile areas, and many of the Jewish men would try to attend these major festivals during the year. Now, Paul was going to ride on one of these Jewish pilgrim ships, but he's going to find out there is a plot to kill him. Apparently, it would have been easy for the Jews out to sea to rile the other Jews and kill Paul and throw him overboard. Paul heard about a specific plot and changed his sea plans. He's not going to go by a pilgrim ship. He's going to go by a commercial ship that didn't stop at every port. So he's going to change his plans here. As he had companions. There's a series of men here. In your notes, I've shown how these men come from different Roman provinces where Paul has taken up this contribution for the saints in Jerusalem. That's why I think Paul wanted to go. Now, he's going to miss Passover because he's going to go by land and on slower ships. So, but he's going to try to make Pentecost 50 days after Passover. Now, these different men are mentioned in other places. Like this Sopater, many think it's the Sosipater of Romans 16:21, but that's uncertain. Notice this Aristarchus is mentioned again. We talked about him earlier where he's mentioned several times in Acts and Colossians 4:10 and then in Philemon 24. This Secundus, we don't know where else he's mentioned in the New Testament. Gaius is mentioned. We've talked about him several possibilities from Derby. Timothy, Paul's favorite companion, mentioned more often than any other person in Paul's letters. Tychicus, now he's mentioned quite often. He not only is the bearer of some of Paul's letters, but possibly the scribe of some of Paul's letters, Ephesians 6, 21 and 22, Colossians 4, 7 and 8, and several other times you can see in your notes. Also, Trophimus, mentioned several times in the New Testament, different places. And they went on to Troas and waited there for us. Now here the us and we sections of Acts continue. Apparently Paul is back in Philippi. He's going to keep the Passover with some Jewish friends there. That's where we last left the physician Luke, and we pick him up here again. Now, some think that Titus is with this group, and he's mentioned in 1 Corinthians as being with this group, with the contribution. There's been much speculation of why Titus is never mentioned by name in Acts. Some think, and this is just speculation, but it seems to be pretty good speculation to me, coming from Ramsey, Paul, and his travels, that maybe Titus was Luke's brother. And Luke was embarrassed about mentioning his own name and his own family, so he leaves Titus out. Well, for some reason, Titus left out, and he probably should be here, so I'm not sure what's happening. Now, you wonder about why Paul would keep Jewish feasts. When he's so adamant about the Gentiles don't have to, why would he personally keep them? You must remember, this is not a religious freedom argument against the Gentiles, but Paul tried to become all things to all men that he might win some. He kept the Jewish laws because he was a Jew, and he voluntarily submitted them so he could work with Jews. But he did not push that on the Gentile church. So obviously he kept this feast with some of the Jewish converts at Philippi. And then he sailed from Philippi and 5 days joined them at Troas. Now, it only took them one day coming the other direction. Well, the winds were against them. They had to tack back and forth to make it. He had sent the others on ahead. Now, where he spent a week. Now, on the first day of the week, this is interesting, for most of us wonder, is it the first day of the week in the Jewish sense, which would have been Saturday night, or is it the first day of the week in the Roman sense, which would have been Sunday night? Well, I really think it's Sunday night from the other places in the Bible that seems to say that the early church began to meet on Sunday night instead of on the Sabbath. Apparently, in commemoration of the Lord's resurrection and the Lord himself seems to set the pattern in the Gospel of John as he met the church on successive Sunday nights in the upper room. John 20, verses 19 and 26, and then by 1 Corinthians 16:2, which mentions the Lord's Supper, which was written before any of the Gospels were written, they're already meeting on the first day of the week. Now, remember, Sunday was a work day then. They were meeting after work the first day of the week to have their celebration of the Lord's resurrection. We met to break bread. Now, this is obviously the Lord's Supper. Now, the early church had a full meal fellowship, and part of that was the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper. It was apparently done every week, many times in between Sabbaths. For in Acts, we see they took the Lord's Supper every day. But it seemed to have standardized as weekly. You say, well, why don't all churches do it weekly? It's not specifically said, so how often we do it is not a matter of dogmatic biblical theology, but the preference or tradition of different denominations. Now, Paul addressed them, since he was leaving the next day, and prolonged his speech until midnight. Well, he several hours sermon, but boy, they wanted to hear Paul. And there were many lamps in the room upstairs where they met, and a young man named Eutychus. Now, the word young man is different here, but it means a young man between about 20 and 30, something like that, who was sitting on the window, was gradually overcome by heavy drowsiness. And Paul continued to speak longer and longer, and at last he fell fast asleep. Well, it may have been the number of people in the upper room, the lamps they lit may have made him drowsy. He was young. Maybe he'd worked all day. I often use it when I say this in sermons. I say, here's a good example that long sermons are biblical. And it's also a biblical example that falling asleep during long sermons is biblical. Well, this guy fell asleep, and he was sitting in the window, and he fell out of a third-story window. Can you imagine what happened at that church meeting? Well, Paul ran downstairs. Look, it says they fell the third floor to the ground and was picked up dead. Now, Luke, the physician, adds, I think here, by Luke saying he was picked up dead, is Luke's way of saying, I think the guy's dead. And I think he is. And Paul went down and fell on him and embraced him. Now, this is exactly what Elijah and Elisha had done back in 1 Kings 17:21, 2 Kings 4:3. Maybe it was artificial resuscitation. I don't know, but it seems miraculous to me. He laid himself on the boy, and he said, stop being alarmed. Present middle imperative with the May article. They thought he was dead. Paul says, no, I'm going to bring him back. And so he went back upstairs. The guy came back to life. Apparently, they took him to his house and brought him back to the meeting just before it broke up. Paul went back upstairs and finished. He wasn't through with his sermons yet. Had the Lord's Supper then and spoke longer. And after talking with them extendedly, this is the English word we get homiletics from, which is the theological term for preaching. And he preached till daylight. He didn't give up. Boy, he preached right up till daylight. That's why I think it's Roman time, Sunday night, and not Jewish time, Saturday night. And they took the boy home alive and were greatly comforted. We had already gone on board the ship and set for Assos. I hope you'll get a map and look at this different journey here. Paul cuts across land here by himself instead of going with the boat around. Some say he just wanted some time alone. Others say he didn't like the rough sea around the point. I don't know, but Paul needed some time. About a 20-mile trip. So they went to Adis and Miletan and on, and they're going to come to Miletus in verse 15. It's about 28 miles south of Ephesus. Paul did not want to stop at Ephesus. It would take too much time to get into port and out of port. So he calls for the elders, and our next lesson will be Paul's sermon to the Ephesian elders, which is an example of Paul preaching to Christians, as we've already had Paul preaching to proselytes and Paul preaching to pagans, and now we're going to have a sample of Paul's sermons to Christians. And we'll be doing that next week. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you. Don't forget to look at your map on this. It'll help you follow where he's going. And I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.